This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Another hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on a magnificent Tuesday. I don't know how it could possibly get any better. People at the Department of Education are getting fired. This is amazing. And the reporting is, not only have they shut the building down, they've begun laying off half the employees. So that's all right. Now we'll get to, hopefully, an update, a very good update on the Ukraine stuff, some emails and things this hour. But, well, last night I started something and I need to continue it now. Maybe you missed last night's show. I can't imagine that's the case. But if you did miss last night's show, at the start of the second hour, I did Medal of Honor Monday. And then I started into part one of telling a little history about the Crimean War. I am not going to recap it for you here because it took like 45 minutes to get through everything I went through last night. So in order to catch you up in about 30 seconds to a minute, here's what it is. It's the mid-1800s. Russia is an autocratic empire. France and Britain hate each other, but they decide to join forces and fight alongside Turkey to keep Russia from taking over key parts of Turkey. Period. That's where we are. And the reason I'm telling this story in part is because this exact area is what everybody is fighting over today, in case you thought there was anything new under the sun. And the British/French plan was form up a fleet with an army, sail through the Dardanelles. If you don't know what the Dardanelles are, you need to go look them up. Just look up Istanbul and then look just southwest of that. You'll see this strip of water. It's a strip of water that connects the Black Sea to the open ocean. The plan is for the Brits and the French to sail through that and sail up to a place still known as Sevastopol. You can look Sevastopol up on a map. The Black Sea, think of it like a circle. At the top of it, there's this big chunk of land, Crimea. And there's a city there, Sevastopol. Why do the Brits and the French want to sail to this Russian-held place? Their intention is to completely destroy the Russian port so the Russians no longer have a warm water fleet of any kind. The goal is destruction, period. Now, you're all caught up. And off they sail. They sail down that way. They beach somewhere short of Sevastopol. What is the purpose of all this? Why would they stop early? They weren't quite sure what the Russian army was going to do yet. Are they gonna cross the Danube? What are they going to do? The Russians see this and they kind of back off. But during this time, the Brits get introduced to something that the whole world knows about now, but many times throughout history is neglected. The boring, boring thing called logistics, you see. There are a lot of things, many things, we do not fully appreciate as Americans, not because we're ugly Americans or stupid or ungrateful or any of those things. There are things I don't appreciate fully as an American because being an American is all I've ever known. I've only ever known America. And yes, I've traveled other places, but the way America does things is hardly ever talked about. Here, you want the least sexy, to put it mildly, the least sexy aspect of combat that is really, 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 really important, like majorly important. What do you do with all the waste? The human waste. Probably not something that occurred to you, was it? You know, you can watch 100 movies. Platoon and Braveheart and The Gladiator. And that's never addressed at all. That's weird. You can even read 100 books on this war, that battle. And rarely will you get an author to sit and discuss at any length what to do with human waste. Yet that is something, as soon as you get into a situation where that is not done, you will realize quickly you get a bunch of men in one area without a solid plan to remove the waste that comes out of them. Sickness, disease is coming, and it is coming very, very quickly. There has to be a plan for that. I'll tell you another not sexy part of war. And this is, remember, this is just before the Civil War. So these are the kind of weapons we're talking about. Muskets and cannons and things like that. Everyone wants to talk about bayonets, and we're going to get to bayonets today. It's really cool. Everyone wants to talk about bayonets and muskets and cannons. Yeah, well, that's the sexy stuff. How's your medical team? This is one of the things that really separated France and Britain at the time. France had been fighting already for a couple decades. Britain had not been. France had top-notch medical people. Top-notch medical people. Top-notch ambulance systems for their troops in the field. This guy's wounded. We can save him. Get him on the ambulance. Get him this place. He needs soap and water. Clean sheets. Britain, none of that. It was just like they were completely lost. Oh, they showed up with plenty of guns, plenty of troops, plenty of cannons, plenty of bravery. They acquitted themselves very well in this war. Logistically, not so much. They get to this area where the Russians aren't even, and they have this massive camp set up, and cholera comes in. Terrible, terrible disease. Soon, without a shot fired, they're losing a sixth of their men before a shot has even been fired. That is the beginning of the horrible, long disaster that is the Crimean War. Now, we'll fast forward through that. Eventually, they figure, okay, enough of this. It's time to get back on the boats, and it's time to sail towards Sevastopol. British Army, French Army, they sail into the Black Sea, and they sail towards Sevastopol. Here's a funny little historical tidbit for you I read, and I cracked up when I read it. It's just so funny how wild sometimes are. The invading fleet that intended to take down Sevastopol, and remember, the Russians in Sevastopol know that that's what the fleet is coming to do. They were sailing towards it. They couldn't land there. There just isn't a good place for a big army to land there by it. But they did sail by Sevastopol. The Russian troops on the fort and the British and French troops on the boats were saluting each other on the way by. Just a totally different era, right? Hey, salute you, pal. The army, this big army, they sail. They land a little ways away. And they begin to march towards Sevastopol. Now, at this point, the French, they are better troops than the British. They just are because of experience. There's no substitute for experience when it comes to combat. Like I've said many times, the French had been fighting, the Brits had not been. And there's another part of this that is going to come into play time and time again in the story here. The French and the British hate each other. They just freaking hate each other historically. If you know anything about that continent, they have been at each other's throats at various times throughout history, really since the history of both of them. They're just two countries that don't get along. The French and the English are always fighting. Now they've joined forces now, but they're always fighting. And during this conflict, I mentioned it yesterday. I didn't actually mention his name. But I mentioned it yesterday. Ragland is his name, in case you're interested. But the big cheese for the British Army, he happens to be missing an arm. His right arm, if I remember right. He's missing an arm. Weird. How did you lose that arm, Mr. Ragland? He lost that arm fighting the French at Waterloo. That's how deep the hatred runs here with each other. They land, and it is time to launch their first attack on the Russians. And they are in a bad, bad spot right off the bat. You see, they're down below. The Russians are kind of on top on this ridge line. So they have to figure out what they're going to do about that. And the plan is this. Let's have the French scale the cliffs and flank the Russians. So the Brits will charge up the hill, the French will flank, and they'll tear the Russians up. This all works out, and they have a terrible, terrible battle with muskets and bayonets and cannons, and all kinds of people die. But eventually the Russians are forced to flee the field, and they're decimated. And now the road to Sevastopol is wide open in front of the French and the British. They can go do what they wanted to do. But let's talk about that next.
Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful Tuesday. We're going to get back to the politics probably in 10 minutes from now, maybe 20 minutes from now. We're continuing on our Crimean War. This is part two tonight of the Crimean War history. Remember, you can email the show, love, hate, death threats, whatever else you'd like. Email those into jesse@jessekellyshow.com. The French, the British, they join together. They fight against this Russian army right outside of Sevastopol, and they devastate the Russian army. And now, laid bare in front of them is the undefended city of Sevastopol. The city they sailed pretty much across all the way around Europe to get to and into the Black Sea. They just fought a brutal battle with bayonets, muskets, and cannons. They defeated the Russian army, and there is the city waiting for them. And then it's hard to explain how disastrous this decision turned out to be for so many people. The Allies, I'm just going to refer to them as the Allies, the British and the French, they decide they're not going to march into Sevastopol. They decide they're going to march around it, so they can attack it from the opposite side once they get back to the coast and hang out near their ships. This is not a decision that is celebrated amongst the elites, the generals in the British Army. The Big Cheese wants to do it. The others are screaming at him because, and remember, you can look at pictures of this. There are pictures, not a bunch and not great ones, but there are pictures of the Crimean War. The generals in the British Army are screaming at their commander, "Sir, look at them. I'm looking at the town. There are no defenses. There are no troops. We could walk into the town now. Sir, please, it's empty. The streets are empty. It's nothing but a bunch of frantic civilians. Sir, please, march in now." But he will not do it. And his defense was, "No, I don't want to start any kind of an attack unless I have my boats, which are where all my supplies are, right behind me. So I don't want to attack from the north. I will only attack from the south." He marches around Sevastopol instead of going in. Then he waits. Then he waits while the big guns are brought up, while everything is dug in. And what do you think the Russians are doing during all this waiting? They're digging defenses. They're bringing in guns. The Russian Navy at this point in time knew they couldn't hang with the British Navy and the French Navy. The French Navy was there too. The Russian Navy, you know what they did? They sunk themselves. They sunk themselves in strategic places around the area to prevent British and French ships from getting into places. And then the sailors on these Russian ships took over the defense of Sevastopol. The delay in taking back Sevastopol probably cost a million lives. One of those strategic decisions in the history of warfare that probably cost a million lives. And if you were the commander, one of the guys who made that call, if you have any conscience at all, you probably went to bed many, many nights for the rest of your life, dwelling on the fact that you cost a lot of people their lives. Anyway, so they dig in. The trenches start digging in on both sides. The Crimean War was actually studied not only by the guys who fought the Civil War about 10 years after this. It was studied by guys who fought World War I. Why? because trench warfare has finally decided to visit us. Pause. Let's discuss why. Remember how many times BK has come on here and talked about the war in Ukraine? And we were talking about what are the advances? What has changed in warfare versus what we know? And what is the thing BK hammers on over and over and over and over and over again? He's not the only one. Every super spook military guy I know speaks like this. Drones. Drones, drone technology has just changed warfare. It is a new offensive weapon that has changed warfare. With one cheap little drone and a little explosive, you can take out a tank. Now, what can you do with an advanced drone? What about a drone that flies 200 miles an hour? What if you had a drone swarm of 1,000 of them with explosives on them that travel 200? Now, are you seeing what it can be? There is now an offensive weapon. Do you want to know why the Russian lines and Ukrainian lines rarely move in the current war, Russia-Ukraine? Because there is not, as of right now, an effective counter to the offensive weapon. And when there's not an effective counter to an offensive weapon, what do? Human beings always do it. You saw it in World War I, and now you see it in the Crimean War. If there's a weapon you cannot counter, you dig down. Because digging a hole, a trench, is the only chance you have to stay alive. If you don't have any way to counter a drone, all you can do is dig a trench, get something over your head that'll prevent it from seeing you, and pray when that buzzing sound comes that it buzzes right by you. Well, here in the Crimean War, there are advancements in warfare that won't sound, that don't sound huge to us now because of how far removed we are from this conflict. But if you actually think about it, they get a lot more ugly, and trench warfare becomes a lot more understandable. We'll continue that, at least one more segment of this in a moment. Hang on.
Missed out? Catch up. JesseKellyShow.com.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful Tuesday. We'll get to the Ukraine stuff, the USAID stuff here in a minute. I'm going to wrap up part two of the Crimean War here. I already said where we are in the story. They defeated the Russian army. They could have walked into Sevastopol. They chose not to. Instead, they delayed. They walked around the city. Now the Russian trenches are getting deeper. The British trenches are getting deeper. The French trenches are getting deeper. Fortifications getting thicker. Big guns being brought up. Reinforcements brought in. It all in all is pretty much a horrible situation. And oh, did I mention the British and French hate each other? Yeah, they hardly communicate, even though they're fighting on the same side. In fact, their two lines, their two camps, if you will, they're in separate areas. The French area is over here. The British area is over here. So they're working together, but not really working together. It's a big old freaking mess. Now comes one of the parts. Well, actually, there's a couple parts of this story that I should drop in on you here. So I think it might maybe help you make a connection with something. What's the name of the most famous nurse you can think of historically? Anybody? Famous nurse? Anything? Florence Nightingale. She's on most people's lists. Florence Nightingale. Did Corey guess right? Oh, Chris guessed right. Yeah, right. Anyway, Florence Nightingale. How? Why do we know that name? Because Florence Nightingale was British. And Florence Nightingale began to get the reports back at home of how disgusting and horrible the medical conditions were. And so she stepped in here, which we'll get to that in a little bit. Another name you probably know, or at least the name of a book. Ever heard of the book War and Peace? Chris rolled his eyes. Everyone's heard of War and Peace. Who wrote that book? Tolstoy. Where would Tolstoy ever learn about war and peace? Tolstoy was a Russian in Sevastopol during all this. That's where Tolstoy learned all that. So there's a couple of little Crimean War tidbits. Anyway, now time for probably the most famous moment of this entire war. The Russians, they decide they're not going to sit inside of the city forever. They want to go out and they want to bust up the British lines and maybe steal some of their guns. So they counterattack. They try to cut through the British lines. They do successfully run off a lot of the Turks. The Turks actually put up a very heroic defense here, but it's a fading empire. They didn't have the people for it. And the Russians do start stealing some of the guns. Now comes a moment of an all-time miscommunication moment that turned out to be horrific slash heroic. I guess it depends on whether or not you're one of the people who got hit by a cannonball. The British had this elite unit known as the Light Brigade. The Light Brigade is what they were known as. It was a cavalry unit. They're all on horseback. We're talking straight up old school sabers and the works. The Big Cheese and the Light Brigade gets a note that says, "Hey, gosh, go get those guns." I'm paraphrasing, but that's what it says. Now, the note was not referencing the gigantic Russian line of cannon that were aimed at the Light Brigade at the moment. The note was not saying charge the cannon line. The note was in reference to the guns over the hill that the Russians were currently stealing. "Hey, Light Brigade, ride your horses down there and stop them from stealing the guns." That's what the note was meant to say. But when you paraphrase things, things can be misinterpreted. The head of the Light Brigade interpreted this note as an order for him to form up his 600, about 632, if I remember right, 632 members of the Light Brigade against a wall of Russian cannon and charge. Now, I mentioned the advances in warfare, and I delayed mentioning it until now. Cannon is not new. Napoleon used cannon. Cannons weren't new. But cannons had advanced in such a significant way. In fact, one of the parts of this battle, this war I didn't even go into, was at the very beginning of it, the Russian Navy incinerated a huge portion of the Turkish Navy because they had something the Turks hadn't seen, exploding cannonballs. You may think that's just something that always happened. Everyone's cannonballs exploded. No. Lots of times it was just a solid metal ball. But technology being what it is, guns, heavy guns, cannons, mortars, they had advanced past what normal people were used to facing on the battlefield. I actually personally witnessed, when I was in France, I witnessed a piece of armor. You can go look it up to this day if you'd like. It's fascinating. You can look it up online if you're not traveling, where one of Napoleon's guys, he was wearing an all-metal, I forget what it was, copper maybe? I don't remember what it was, an all-metal breastplate. And you can see there's a gigantic cannonball hole through it where he obviously died pretty much instantly. A cannonball hit him in the breastplate, went right through it, and it's on display to this day. It's famous. The guy was hero, charged, dead. So that's how cannonballs used to operate. In this era, they do more devastating things. And the 600 men of the Light Brigade pulled out their sabers like warriors and did as they were told and charged a line of cannon. Like I said, you can call it stupidity, you can call it heroism, I don't know what you want to call it, but I know if you're on a horse with a saber in your hand charging a line of cannon, you are made of tougher stuff than I am. Brits certainly don't have anything to be ashamed of. It's a famous charge for a reason. The Russians were obviously a bit taken aback by these psychos charging them on a horse, started firing away and blowing them away. The Brits managed to get clear into the Russian lines where they started hacking off Russian heads and arms. I told you this thing gets real, real ugly. I haven't even gotten to some of the worst of it yet. They then blow through the Russian gun line and head back towards the Russian cavalry and start fighting with them. Soon, they're very clearly overmatched and they're about to be annihilated. The French recognize this, charge in, and the Light Brigade has to charge back through the Russian lines of cannon they had just fought through initially, and they are butchered during this entire process. Brave, ridiculously brave, yes, but still butchery nonetheless. By the end of the day, 630 men charged. The Light Brigade had, depending on which accounting you read, about 250 men left. Now, the charge was not all for naught. I don't want to act like it was. Yes, there were Brits dead, wounded, taken prisoner. It was an ugly, ugly affair. But that level of fanatical bravery, at least in the eyes of the Russians, did impact the Russians to such a degree that they never again marched their cavalry out for a battle with the Brits. They thought to themselves, these guys are nutballs and they're pretty good on a horse. I think we'll just go ahead and stay back with the cavalry inside the city. And that brings us to tomorrow, meaning I will get to it tomorrow and I will finish it tomorrow. Start of the second hour, I'll finish it tomorrow. And yeah, it definitely involves troops emerging through the fog 15 feet away with bayonets attached. That kind of thing. Yeah. Crimean War. Underrated war. All right. Let's talk about Ukraine, USAID. Get to emails. Let's get to other things. Let's get to Hillsdale first. Do you like learning about history? Did you enjoy that? I love it. I love talking about it. I geek out on it. Hillsdale will teach you history at no cost. I mean, forget about an idiot like me. Think about Hillsdale teaching you history at no cost. Hillsdale College is offering more than 40 free online courses right now. They're not taking all that wisdom at Hillsdale and just giving it to the kids lucky enough to get into school there. It's for you. It's for me. It's for my kids now. It's something fun, educational to do. Is it raining where you're at? How's the weather? Looking for something to do this evening? Hillsdale.edu/Jesse is where you go to enroll. Go nerd out on some history at no cost. Why wouldn't you? Hillsdale.edu/Jesse. All right. Speaking of Russia, Ukraine, that whole area, something good happened today. Hang on.
Jesse Kelly returns next.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show final segment this hour of the Jesse Kelly Show, but we still have another one coming. Don't worry if you miss any part of the show. You can download the whole thing, iHeart, Spotify, iTunes. Then you can fast forward through the history stuff. Remember, if you want to email the show, you can jesse@jessekellyshow.com. Now, this happened earlier today. This is music to my ears.
Today we made an offer that the
is Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
Today we made an offer that the Ukrainians have accepted, which is to enter into a ceasefire and into immediate negotiations to end this conflict in a way that's enduring and sustainable and accounts for their interests, their security, their ability to prosper as a nation. And hopefully we'll take this offer now to the Russians. And we hope that they'll say yes, that they'll say yes to peace. The ball is now in their court. And but again, the president's objective here is number one, above everything else, he wants the war to end. And I think today Ukraine has taken a concrete step in that regard. We hope the Russians will reciprocate.
Now, this is a wonderful thing. So we should celebrate that. Celebrate when wonderful things happen, right? Things are far from over. How many times have you seen a conflict, followed a conflict, and you saw there was a ceasefire, and then the ceasefire gets broken? And we've talked about this before. I just want to talk about it again. Why would Russia reject it? Well, here's an example. Actually, this is a perfect example. Remember when Ukraine, they pushed into Russia? It was a counteroffensive. It's a common move in war. When you're being invaded, you invade them to try to get their guys to pull back. They feel like they have to play defense. So Ukraine did that with Russia. And then we've gotten word recently, and you never know exactly what the total truth is on the ground. So take this with a grain of salt, but I've seen it from several reliable sources that the Ukraine offensive not only is really, it's not moving forward anymore, but the Russians are cutting them off from the rest of Ukraine. Now that is disaster. If you are a unit and you are completely surrounded by another unit, especially in an artillery war, you're just going to get pounded to mincemeat. They're going to surround you. They're going to line up their guns, point them all to the inner part of the circle, and you're all going to die. Or you have to surrender, which surrendering to the Russians when you're Ukrainian probably doesn't end all that well anyway. The Russians aren't historically the people you generally want to surrender to. Okay? So why would this ceasefire fail? Well, again, I don't know that it will. I hope it'll succeed. What if you're Russia? What if you have a couple divisions of Ukrainians, you just finally cut them off, or you're about to cut them off, and you're about to annihilate a significant chunk of the enemy force? Now, Trump brings this ceasefire agreement to you. Even if you want the war to end, if you're Russia, do you accept that ceasefire? Remember, it's a 30-day ceasefire. What happens to the surrounded Ukrainian troops if you agree to a 30-day ceasefire? Well, they're going to use that 30 days to find a way to scurry back home. And what happens at the end of the 30-day ceasefire if an agreement isn't reached? Then you've just allowed two divisions of your enemy to escape back home, and they're not in the mousetrap for you to annihilate anymore. That was one example of, I wanted to let you know that this journey has all kinds of danger in it, but the journey doesn't start without what happened today. Today, the word is Zelensky sent a letter of apology to Donald Trump for what happened in the White House, and he should have. That was a no-brainer move. He should have apologized. He did. That apparently got the ball rolling forward again. Apparently, Zelensky got a hold of all his new best friends in Europe who've been running their mouths a lot about, we've got your back, we'll always protect you. And apparently the rubber didn't kind of meet the road with Europe. They made a lot of noise. It sounded really great, but the troops, the money, the planes, it didn't end up showing up. So Ukraine felt like they had no other choice. Let's sign a ceasefire. Let's try to get out of this deal. Let's hope the Russians, and who can ever trust the friggin' Russians, but let's hope the Russians decide they've got what they want. A good deal for them is on the table. Let's hope they agree to a ceasefire, which means men stop dying, which is the ultimate goal should be. And then people have to sit down at the table and figure out who gets what. And when I say figure out who gets what, let's be honest. We're going to figure out how much of the territory Russian took. We're going to allow them to keep. And being as how possession is 9/10 of the law, as the saying goes, Russia is going to feel entitled to keep most of it. And you know what's wild is that history story I just told you. It's all this area. That's why I chose to do the Crimean War. It's all this area. And you know what else is wild? Ukraine was ready to sign a peace deal in 2022. And guess who stopped it? The Brits. The Brits, once again, the Brits just can't seem to stay out of here. Boris Johnson and the Brits stepped in and said, no, fight on at all cost. Charge that cannon line. Anyway, but that's what's going on now. And no matter who you are, what you're rooting for, it is a good thing. 1.5 million men dead. That surpasses all of the people we've lost in every war we've ever fought as a country, from the beginning to right now. 1.5 million men dead. That is so insanely sad. And this part of the country, man, look, we just told you a story from the 1850s. Here we are in 2025, and men are still dying in droves in this area. Man, if those fields could talk, right? If that area could talk, how much blood has been soaked into that horrible, horrible soil over there? Remember Stalin's starvation, the Holodomor. It's just how much suffering and pain can one region go through? I don't know. Remember, I've said before that I really think countries like Haiti are cursed. You had a successful slave rebellion, and things are like worse now than they were before. It's just a horrible place. Maybe this area is cursed too. I don't know. But anyway, that's a good thing. Let's talk about USAID. Do some emails. Still paying for DEI training. All that. And an anniversary. Before we get to an anniversary and more, let me remind you that not every company participates with the left with all their disgusting, perverted things they do. Not every cell phone company does. Oh, look, if you have Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, they're going to do the most despicable things with your money, with your money. You will pay your bill, and then they will take it, and they will use it to push the most rancid stuff onto your culture and your children. But Pure Talk has never done that and never will do that. Pure Talk, they don't jack their prices through the roof. Pure Talk still saves you a fortune. They're on the same 5G network, America's most dependable 5G network. They're still giving out brand new iPhones, iPhone 14s, or Samsung Galaxies with a qualifying purchase for no money, $0. Pick up your phone, dial #250 and say Jesse Kelly. #250, say Jesse Kelly. Switch to Pure Talk. We'll be back.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.